So I'm going to talk about PSIP, and I'm really going to have two parts. One is sort of what is PSIP and what's it good for? And then the second part is implementation considerations. You know, how can you actually get it to work in your station? Before I start off on that, just for those of you who aren't familiar with me or my company, it's pronounced Triveni Digital, and we supply various kinds of solutions to digital television broadcasters, PSIP generators, stream analyzers, data broadcast systems, PSIP translators, a stream doctor diagnostic service for DTV broadcast streams, and then we have a custom solutions group for special projects. So that's last you're going to hear about our products for the talk. So the outline of this talk is first just PSIP in a nutshell. As background, talk a little bit about the ATSC transport stream structure and the MPEG-2 PSI tables and ATSC PSIP tables, and then talk about PSIP implementation issues. When I made up the view graphs, I got a little ambitious, and I've got more view graphs here than I'm going to be able to cover in 45 minutes. So I'm going to gloss over some of them kind of quickly and then focus on the ones that seem most important for purposes of this talk. In a nutshell, PSIP, as you may know, stands for Program and System Information Protocol. It's an ATSC standard, which is, I think, ATSC document A65. And it basically describes how to insert metadata into the broadcast stream that can enable receivers to carry out certain functions. One function it enables is tuning by virtual channel numbers. For many of the commercial stations, this is a very big deal because they've gone to a lot of trouble to brand their channel numbers. You know, in New York City, it's Fox 5, that's all one word. And in Washington, D.C., it's NBC4, that's all one word. And the tuning by virtual channel numbers instead of physical broadcast bands for digital television means they can retain that investing in the branding. May not be as important for many PBS stations. I did some browsing around, and I've noticed that a lot of the PBS networks aren't really focusing as much on the channel numbers. And in fact, in many cases, I noticed a lot of you folks are not really focusing on your call letters as much as your network name. I see Bruce here in the front row, for example, and I was looking at the Twin Cities Television website, and, you know, Twin Cities Public Television. I knew I was missing something in the letter there, so TPT is sort of what they focus on, and the call letters to the station and the channel numbers are more or less secondary. And I suspect the reason is because in many cases your stations are really a statewide network, so you're broadcasting on the same content under multiple channel numbers and multiple call letters. So it makes more sense to focus on the actual network name rather than the individual stations. Another thing that PSIP enables is displaying channel names when people change channels. So that, as you probably know, many satellite systems and cable systems through the set-top boxes have the ability that as you switch from one channel to another, when the new channel comes on, the channel number, channel name will come up, and often a short description of what program is currently playing. You know, the name of the program, when it started, when it's going to end, that kind of thing. And what PSIP enables is the same functionality in off-the-shelf digital television sets for over-the-air broadcast without needing a special set-top box, because the data that supports that functionality is right there in the broadcast stream. It also enables interactive electronic program guides, where a viewer can get an on-screen description of programming on your channels, both what's showing now and on into the future. PSIP supports automatic language selection for the audio track. In some areas with digital television, you can be broadcasting multiple different audio tracks with the same video, maybe an English language version, a Spanish language version, a French language version. The users can set up their TV set when they first set it up to say what their language preference is, and because of the PSIP data there, the receiver can automatically select the right language track when there are multiple tracks available. The VSIP chip function, the parental content blocking, that only works if you have PSIP data in the broadcast stream. There's no PSIP data there, there's just nothing that the VCHIP functionality has to work with, and so it's just inoperative. And one other minor thing that it does is lets the TV receiver know the time of day, because it's always getting sent in the broadcast stream an accurate time of day indication. So that As you know, these days, when your power goes out and comes back on, you spend the next 20 minutes wandering around your house resetting all the clocks on your microwave oven and your clock radios and your TV set, your hi-fi set, and everything else. With PSEP data, if it's done correctly, at least the TV set will be able to set itself. And of course, when we get to the days of home networks, it'll be able to set everybody else as well, so you won't have to walk around the house and do that. So those are some of the things that it's good for. So let's now talk about the broadcast stream and a little bit about how the PSEP data fits into that and see how it does it. As you probably know, and ATSC broadcast stream, digital broadcast stream, may have multiple virtual channels. Some can be video channels, which have, you know, some audio with them and maybe some data. Some can be just audio channels that may also have some data with them, or there can be data-only channels. These are all based on the basic construct of the MPEG-2 transport stream. MPEG-2 transport stream is just a sequence of 188-byte so-called transport packets. Each packet has a 4-byte header and 184-byte payload, where the payload is carrying the encoded video or encoded audio or data or PSEP data or whatever. And the way this works is that these transport packets are really carrying a lot of interleaved elementary streams, where each packet belongs to a particular elementary stream. So each packet would belong to a particular video stream or a particular audio stream or a data stream. And the way that you can tell, sort these packets out, is each packet has a so-called PID or packet identifier in the packet header that tells what stream it belongs to. So in this example, you can see there's just a short example there with four transport packets. Two of them had PID 5. One has 7 and one has 19, conveniently color-coded so you can tell them apart. The receiver, of course, doesn't have the color coding to guide it. It has to just go by the numbers. This is a picture of what the a typical transport stream might look like. Fairly simple case. You've got, I can see we're having the problem I sometimes have with this computer where it clips things, so let's do that. And that gets it all back on the screen. What you have there is, at the top, some PSEP tables that are being generated by a PSEP generator, and those are going in a sequence of transport packets. And then there's a data channel that has, just, in this case, a single data stream that's got a bunch of transport packets, and a data-enhanced audio-video channel, like interactive TV, and that's got some audio packets and video packets and data packets, and then just a plain, ordinary audio-video channel with audio and video. So you've got all these different streams, neatly color-coded here, and they go into a multiplexer, and what comes out is what you see at the bottom, with the usual slight problems because overhead projectors are not great on colors. But what you see there is all the different packets are just all interleaved, and the problem with a receiver is to sort them back out again. So when those get to the receiver gets this stream of interleaved packets, and it has to go through and sort out, depending on what virtual channel the viewer has tuned to, it has to pick out all those packets that have the PID for the video and the packets that have the PID for the audio and feed those into the decoders, and then that gets the picture that shows up on the stream. And a good part of what PSEP is one function of the PSEP data is to help the receiver pick out the right, know what PIDs it has to pick out and route them to the decoders. So the ATSC PSEP standard is actually an extension to the basic MPEG-2, what's called program-specific information, or PSI, which does allow a receiver to pick things out, but in a considerably less versatile way than it can do with the PSEP. So the two primary, and what they call tables, and these tables are just little data structures that get packed up into transport packets and then put into the broadcast stream. The two basic structures for the MPEG-2 are the PAT, or Program Association Table, and what it has in it is a list of all of the programs that are in the broadcast stream, what MPEG-2 calls programs, what ATSC calls virtual channels. It sort of has a list of all the ones that are in the transport stream, and it tells where you can find the program map table for each one of those. That is, it gives the PID that contains the program map table for each one. So then for each one of those programs are virtual channels. You have a program map table, and what the program map table in turn does is tells what elementary streams are in that virtual channel and gives their PIDs. For each elementary stream, it gives its PID, and it also tells what type it is. Is this a video stream or an audio stream or a data stream, or what exactly is it? And so with the MPEG-2 structures alone, you can tune by physical channel number and MPEG-2 program number. So a receiver could, if you simply, and one of the problems that receivers have right now is that in some cases they're having to tune by, the original ATSC concept was that you would tune always by these virtual channel numbers that are listed that are given in the PSIP data. Many stations are not putting any PSIP data in, so some of the early receivers had a lot of trouble with that because they were looking for the virtual channel table, the part of the PSIP data to tune, and when they couldn't, they weren't sure what to do. The receivers now are more versatile because they've learned they had to be to make up for the deficiencies of some of the broadcasters, and so they allow you to tune by either physical channel number and MPEG-2 program number or by virtual channel number. And if all you've got is MPEG, all you can do is go by these physical channel number. This is just a graphical view of what I just described about the PAT and PMT. Simply showing the PAT pointing to the PMTs and the PMTs pointing to the elementary streams. Then the ATSC PSIP tables, there are 8 of them. And I'm just going to list them here, and then as I go through the other later view graphs, describe a little bit more about what they do. The MGT is basically the roadmap to all of the other PSIP tables. It contains a list of the other PSIP tables, and for each one, it gives the PID so that the receiver can find it. And as you can see in this little table here, the MGT has a list of the various PSIP tables that are in the stream, and for each one, it says which table it is, what PID the table is in, that is where you can find the transport packets carrying that table, what version of that table is the current version that's in the broadcast stream, what its size is, and sometimes a little bit of other information. One important thing is this version number here, because it basically says that anytime any PSIP table changes version, an entry in the MGT will change, which forces a change in the MGT's version number. So a receiver can simply monitor the MGT, look at its version number, and as long as that doesn't change, it knows that none of the PSIP tables have changed. And the only time it really has to go start parsing the PSIP tables and picking up new information out of them is when it sees a change in the MGT version number. And it can then look at the MGT in detail and see, well, which tables have changed, and then go pick those up. The virtual channel table is the one that plays the really key role in tuning. It has all of the same information as the MPEG-2 PAT and PMTs, plus some more. It allows tuning by these virtual channel numbers, which, as you probably know, come in the form of a major channel number and then a minor channel number. The ATSC requirement is that the major channel number in the United States, the major channel number should match your analog channel number, and then the minor channel number can be any number you want between 1 and 99. The VCT is what supports language track selection. It's what provides a channel name so that can be displayed on the screen by the tuner when you change channels or at other times. And probably the big thing that's important is that ATSC receivers were typically designed to use the virtual channel table. If it's not there, their behavior can be kind of unpredictable. And I'm sure you've read in news stories at one time or another about various problems tuners are having with various broadcasts. And very often what those things, if you look at those problems and trace down what's going on, the problem is that the PSIP data was not really compliant with the standard and the receiver got confused. This is simply a description of the virtual channel table and the sort of things that's in it. It has a short channel name, which is up to 7 characters, which receivers will typically display on the screen at appropriate times. Major channel number, minor channel number. Transport stream ID, which is simply a unique identification of that transport stream, which it's typically used by a receiver to index the various transport streams it's seen when it's caching information about them. It has the MPEG-2 program number, which is primarily used to just cross-reference with the PAT and PMTs. It has a flag which is called a hidden flag and a hide-from-guide flag. There are really two flags there. Big value of those is that if you're changing your channel lineup at different times of the day, so sometimes you've got maybe one HD channel and sometimes you have multiple SD channels, there's a field down here called the source ID, which provides the linkage between the virtual channel and the information that describes the events or TV programs that are in your virtual channel. And if you don't have a virtual channel entry in the virtual channel table, then there's nothing for those that other stuff to link to. So if you want to provide program guide information about all of your channels, you need to put your channels in the virtual channel table whether they're currently on the air or not. You know, in order to have program guide information on all of your channels, you need to have them all in the virtual channel table, even when they're not on the air. Well, obviously, you then have to have some way to let the receiver know which of these are on the air and which ones aren't, so it knows which ones it can really tune to and which ones are simply there to provide a linkage to the program guide information. And these two little fields here are what do it. If you say that this is a hidden channel, that tells the receiver don't tune to it, don't try to tune to it. And if you say, but don't hide it from the guide, that says, oh, this is just a channel that's now off the air. You should be prepared to put information about it in the program guide. You can also have hidden channels which you do want to hide from the guide, and those would be used for things like test channels, or possibly if you have some kind of proprietary data broadcast channels you don't want receivers to get confused about, you can label them as hidden and hide from guide, and they're invisible to everything that isn't especially looking for them. Gives the service type, tells whether it's an audio channel, video, data, and it also tells whether it's an analog channel or a digital channel. You can use the PSIP data to provide programming information about your analog channel, as well as your analog broadcast, as well as the channels that are in your digital broadcast. And this field, the service type field, is what tells the receiver that the information here is about an analog program. Don't try to tune to it, but be prepared to provide program guide information about it. And then the service location descriptor gives the pointer to all the elementary streams. It's really doing the same thing that the PMTs are doing. So that's probably in more detail than you wanted to see what the virtual channel table has and how it supports the various things that I stated that the PSIP data supports. Another important set of tables are the event information tables and extended text tables, and these are what provide the more detailed programming information about your individual TV programs. And these can be used to support on-screen program information when you do channel changes and things like that, or typically a digital television receiver will just let you have, you know, on request through your remote control, can call up information about the current program that's playing. And this is an extremely important feature for attracting viewers to your program. I know I have a cable system at home that has a set-top box, and I'm used to being able to kind of surf through the channels, and every time I come to a channel, it tells me what channel number it is, channel name, and what the current program is. And I kind of rely on that to decide, am I really interested in stopping to see this, or am I going to just go on to the next channel? And so if there's no PSIP data there, you're going to have a lot of viewers when they're surfing, they're just going to surf past. Because if what they're looking at right this instant isn't really interesting, they won't have something, description that tells them, yeah, this may not be interesting this instant, but there's going to be some interesting stuff coming. And then you also can typically click again and get a more extended definition of the program which is on. And again, that can be very useful in attracting people to stay with that channel and look for it and watch it. The PSIP data also supports the interactive program guide. What all of this amounts to is that if you don't have PSIP data in your transport stream, you've really lost a chance to attract viewers. They will often just not stop on your channel, or they will not tune to your channel when they would tune to it or stop on it if they had this data available to them. This is just a quick look at what an interactive program guide, electronic program guide looks like. And with this kind of a program guide, what the viewer would typically be able to do is scroll up and down through the channels and back and forward through time by clicks on their remote control. As was mentioned in the introduction, I'm chairing an ATSC committee that's working on extending an enhanced PSIP standard to support advanced electronic program guide functionality. Some of the things that would provide is things like channel logos that would show up in your guide, and things like trailers that, you know, when you're looking and you've highlighted a particular program in the guide, it would maybe show you a short trailer of what's in that program. This may not be quite as interesting to the PBS community, but something that's quite interesting to the commercial stations is the possibility of putting advertising in the program guide. So what these event information tables, they describe events, and I won't go into great detail in the structure as to the key thing is that they use this source ID to reference what virtual channel they're part of. They have a listing for different events, and each one gives an ID, which is just a unique identifier, when it starts, how long it lasts, the title, and that title is what they call a multiple string structure. They can actually give the title in multiple languages. So depending on what the viewer has said during the setup stage, the receiver will display the title in the language of the viewer's preference. And then it has some descriptors. One is content advisory rating. One is the closed captioning indicator. And then there's an AC3 audio descriptor, which tells things like, is this stereo sound or is this 5.1 surround sound? So these are all things that can be displayed in the program guide or in on-screen information to help the user see what's currently playing. Key fact about these EITs is there are up to 128 of them, each covering a three-hour period. And those three-hour periods are on kind of rigid time intervals from, you know, midnight, 3 a.m., 6 a.m., 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., 6 p.m., and so on, Greenwich Mean Time. So that's the how those come. EIT0 is always the three-hour period that contains the current time. And then EIT1 is the next 3 hours after that, and EIT2 is the next 3 hours after that. ATS standard requires that a station should put at least the first four of these in the broadcast stream, so up to 12 hours ahead. And many stations put quite a bit more than that. Extended text tables simply give extended text descriptions of the programs. System timetable I mentioned earlier just gives the clock time, and it gives it in Greenwich Mean Time. So to display accurate local time, the receiver simply depends on the fact that the viewer, and during some kind of a setup stage, will have told the receiver what time zone it's in, and then it will convert all of these times that are in the broadcast stream in Greenwich Mean Time, will convert them into local time for display. There's the radiant region table, which defines the content advisory system that's being used, or possibly systems if you're in an area that you're broadcasting across national boundaries and the different nations may have different systems. It turns out in the United States this table was essentially worthless. And the reason is that the full semantics of the rating system that's used in the United States, the parental guideline system, cannot be captured by the data structures in this table. Some of the hierarchical relationships and other relationships that are there simply cannot be represented in this table. So what it amounts to is the receiver for North American television has to have the rating system hardwired into the receiver. And if this table is not present, it probably won't bother the receiver. They've got the information hardwired anyway. That may not be true in other countries, however. The last two tables are the so-called directed channel change table and directed channel change selection code table. These were just added to the PSIP standard last summer, approved, I believe, in July. What the directed channel change table does is says to the receiver, if you're watching this channel now, you should switch to that channel based on various factors such as viewer preferences, viewer demographics, location. Now, for this to work, of course, I think almost all receivers will be set up so that this function does not come into effect unless the user has specifically enabled it. I suspect it will be, you know, the sets will be delivered with this disabled by default, and viewers have to enable it. And, of course, viewers, through some kind of a setups phase, will have to tell the receiver the things, give it the information that it can use for this, like tell it what zip code they live in, any demographic information they want to tell it. Any preferences, like what types of programming they like. Do they like sports? Do they like news? Do they like Westerns, you know, movies? but if that information has been entered in and the functionality has been enabled, then you can do these kinds of channel changes. The DCC selection code table simply gives a downloadable version of the codes that can be used to drive the preferences, you know, the genre, so to speak, of the television programs. In my mind, one of the times that this is going to be very useful and almost essential, actually, is when you're switching back and forth between multiple SD channels and one HD channel. If, for example, you're switching from multiple SD channels to one HD channel, pretty much by definition, several of those SD channels are going to just suddenly stop broadcasting at a particular point. If a viewer is tuned to one of those channels when it goes off the air, what's the receiver going to do? There's no standard that specifies what the receiver has to do, so the behavior is going to be unpredictable. You know, the viewer is tuned to one of your SD channels. There comes a point when you switch from that SD, from this multiple SD channels to a single HD channel, so several of your SD channels go off the air, and the behavior of the receiver in that situation is going to be unpredictable. There's no guarantee that it will switch to your HD channel. It may switch to, you know, anything. Well, with the directed channel change feature, what you can do is simply direct it at the point at which your SD channels go off the air to switch to the HD channel, and that way they'll all converge on, and they'll stay on your channel instead of going off possibly somewhere else. By the same token, when you switch from the HD back to SD, what you may well do is switch different viewers to different SD channels based on location, their preferences to what kind of programs they like to view, and that kind of thing. So, at first, this directed channel change may seem like, what do I want to do with use that for? But in the situation when you're doing these channel lineup changes, it can be very powerful. Well, this is the big picture of all the PSEP tables and their interrelationships. I encourage you to study that sometime. Okay, that gets us through the background on what PSEP is and what it can do for you. And then the question, and this is really, I think, the main point of this talk, is, well, how do you make it work? You know, what are some of the implementation issues? As you probably know, there's been a lot of controversy because a lot of stations do not have PSEP right for various reasons. And so what I want to talk about a little bit is, what does it take to really do PSEP right so that you will have accurate, complete, accurate, consistent data in the broadcast stream, and do it with the minimum effort on your part? So if you're going to implement PSEP data in your broadcast stream, there are really three main things you have to do. First, you have to gather the correct information. You have to get all the tables formatted correctly, and you have to get the timing all correct. And then you have to actually accomplish the insertion into the broadcast stream. Many people think about PSEP as just kind of getting something that inserts the data into the broadcast stream. And yeah, well, maybe they get the table formats correct and the timing correct, but they totally forget the first step here, to gather the correct information. And that's actually the hard part. Getting the tables formatted correctly and put into the stream with the right timing and all that's fairly straightforward. Getting the information together, as I think many of you know who have been working with it, can be a much more complicated and much more expensive proposition. In fact, if you look at the total cost of delivering PSEP data, probably that gathering the correct information is the hard part, or can be the hard part if you don't do it right. Other things you need to consider is, how does your PSEP generation system fit into your entire station environment? And this is especially when you're talking about gathering the correct information. How can you leverage the ways in which you're managing information now and make that all fit together? And you also need, when you find a PSEP solution, to find something that's actually going to evolve as your station evolves. You know, I think I think everybody would agree with me that if you have a digital television station now and you look ahead 5 years, you're probably going to be using, you're probably not going to be using the same equipment now you're using in, 5 years from now, you're probably not going to be using the same equipment you're using now. It may not be coming from the same vendors. You may have, you know, expanded in a lot of different directions, able to encode more things in high definition, different channels. There's going to be a lot of changes in your station. Going to be changes in your traffic systems, changes in your automation systems, changes in your asset management systems. And you need to make sure that you sort of, when you're thinking about PSEP, think of it as part of this whole process, not just an isolated little box that sits here all by itself. So gathering the information, there are typically a couple of approaches you can take. One is manual entry and editing of the data going into a PSIP generator, and another is various automated interfaces. Things to think about with manual entry of the data and editing of the data is you want to make sure that the people that are entering that data can do it operating in the context and with the terminology they're used to. You don't want them to have to understand the complexities of these ATSC PSIP tables that we just talked about. And you don't want them to have to kind of operate in that terminology. You want to be able to operate in the terminology of, you know, there's channels and there's programs, TV programs, the same way we always think about them. In many cases, you're going to want to think in terms of remote user interfaces for different departments. For example, if you want to have accurate descriptions of what's in your news programs, those are really going to have to be provided by your news departments shortly before the programs go on the air. If you want to handle the timing of your, make sure that the time intervals of your PSIP tables are adjusted correctly, that's in the realm of the engineering department. Nobody else wants to worry about that. If you're doing last-minute changes in programming, and some program has run over by 5 or 10 minutes, and you're going to have to adjust for that, those changes are going to typically be made by somebody at master control or programming or something like that. So you need to be able to accommodate all of that. The example I just mentioned, when a program runs overtime, you may make a decision like you're going to let that one run overtime, and you want the next two programs to both just slide their schedule without having any time taken out of them, then take the time out of a period after that. You'd like to be able to do all that with one operation instead of having to go through and separately adjust several different, the start times and end times of several different programs. You'd like to just be able to say, this one's going to overrun 10 minutes and take it out of the fourth one down. Automated interfaces, there are three primary ones that come to mind. One you can get a subscription to a listing service, something like TMS. Most stations keep the listing services up to date on your programming because they're going to print it in newspapers and that kind of thing. And so you can leverage that investment by just getting a subscription and having that data come back to you, enhanced with the information out of their databases. Another possibility is an interface to a traffic system. Your traffic system typically knows what programs you're going to be running when, so you can simply feed that information directly into a PSIP generator. It's probably not such a big deal now, but as people start doing much more dynamic things with their digital television, the interface to an automation system is going to become increasingly important. Since the receivers are dependent on the virtual channel table for tuning, when you do a switch from one HD channel to multiple SD channels or vice versa, you need to have a change in your virtual channel table at the splice point. You really don't want to do it, 5 seconds ahead of the splice point or 5 seconds after the splice point. You really want it to happen at the splice point because receivers are going to get confused otherwise. So, I maintain that to get that kind of timing, you're probably going to have to get the automation system in the act so that it's both sending commands to some of your other equipment to do the splices and sending commands to the PSIP generator to switch over at the same time. Just a quick indication of the sort of thing about the user interface and complexity. On the right-hand side, you see just kind of a listing of all the PSIP tables and the various fields are in them. And what you don't want your users to have to do is to muck around with understanding all of that structure. What you want them to do is have a user interface that looks something like that, where they say, oh, I've got a bunch of television programs, and they start at this time, and they end at this time, and this is their title. And, these are each kind of correlated with a channel. I've got some tabs here. I click this channel. I see the programs for that channel. I click that channel. I see the programs for that one. This is the kind of... Go away. That's the kind of user interface that you'd like to have, something that's much more natural, the way people think about television programming, not ATSC PSIP tables. Remote user interface considerations. These are examples of some of the things that you'd like to have. You may need to have master control putting in data for certain things, your news department for certain things, programming department, traffic, engineering. You may need to have these different interfaces. And what you typically want to do is make sure that those interfaces have permissions associated with them that restrict the people in those departments to doing what they need to do and not accidentally messing up other stuff. You don't want the engineering department to be putting in the detailed description of what's going to be in the news program. And you don't want the news program to be messing around with the timing intervals between PSIP tables getting sent out. Some thoughts about the automated interfaces. A subscription to a listing service has advantages and disadvantages. One advantage is it leverages your existing input. You've already gone to a lot of trouble to make sure the listing services know what programs you've got on when. By simply subscribing to that data from the listing service to go into your PSIP tables, you take advantage of all that effort you're already doing to keeping that data correct. It also leverages their program information database. The listing services like TMS and the others in that field typically augment what you give them with a lot of background information they have. You know, if you're going to play a movie, they already know the synopsis of the movie and when it was produced and you know, whether it's a 2-star movie or a 5-star movie and what its content rating is and all of that kind of stuff. You know, who the actors and director are. And so they can augment all of that information out of their database to the information, to the sort of basic information you give them that I'm going to run this movie during this time period. The disadvantage, of course, is that the subscription costs something. Although typically the subscription to a service like that costs a whole lot less than it would cost any kind of manual data entry. Well, traffic system, big advantage of an interface to your traffic system is that it leverages that existing information. You've already gone to a lot of trouble to make sure your traffic system has, you know, it's really driving your programming, and you can leverage what you've already put in there to drive your PSIP as well. And interface to your automation system, I think one of the big ones there is just making sure that you get the precise timing of various changes that have to happen to the VCT. Well, then you get to, okay, now we actually have to insert the PSIP data into the broadcast. And this is where it gets to this issue of being able to have a PSIP generator that will evolve with your station and operate with whatever equipment you have now or in the future. So you really need to be able to both input data from a wide variety of different sources and output that data to a wide variety of different encoders and multiplexers using a wide variety of different protocols. If you get a PSIP generator that is only able to work with a single multiplexer or a single encoder, then as your station evolves, you're likely to end up with a piece of equipment that you can't actually use. This is yet another picture of sort of how the PSIP generator fits into the overall station environment with all the different things around that it might be interacting with. And this is simply summarizing what's really in those diagrams, is that, well, you need to be able to interoperate with diverse data sources to take account of how you may do things in the future. You want to be able to merge data from different data sources. Interoperable with lots of encoders and multiplexers. Fault tolerance is something that most people aren't paying too much attention to yet, because there are so few people watching digital television that most of the people broadcasting digital television are not too concerned if they go off the air for short periods of time. But fault tolerance is going to become increasingly important as it becomes a mainstay of your operations. And finally, you need a PSIP system that will support future extensions to the standard. You know, you need to make sure you got a vendor who's really committed to moving with the standard. So, summary of all this. First, I hope I've convinced you that PSIP really is important. If for nothing else, at some point I suspect that the FCC is going to start mandating VCHIP functionality in digital television receivers. If you don't have PSIP data in your broadcast stream, you're going to be violating that mandate. And then, quite aside from that, there are just a lot of advantages in terms of being able to attract viewers to watch your programming. So it is important. And when you get a PSIP generation system, and there are a lot of systems on the market, there are a lot of good systems on the market. You know, it's not a matter of nobody selling a PSIP system. There are lots of them that you can buy. and they will do a correct job of getting the PSIP data into the broadcast stream. But you need to find one that's easy to use, has highly automated interfaces so as to minimize your staffing costs, and can be fully integrated into your station environment. And I guess there's still some time for questions.
I'm Jan Pritzel from Milwaukee Public Television. We have one of your systems, and I'm asking how you maintain correct time.
Good question. The question is how we maintain correct time. And this applies, I think, not to our system, but to anybody's system, PSIP generator. It is important that it maintain correct time. And, you know, as a first approximation, you can have the PSIP generator just use the time from your PC. You know, the PSIP generators are typically running on a personal computer or some kind of a computer that has a built-in time clock. But if you're going to do that, you'd better be prepared to kind of manually check that clock once a day and make sure that it's more or less accurate. Fortunately, the PSIP standard, the standard actually only requires accuracy to plus or minus 4 seconds. And while PC clocks drift, they don't drift so fast that you can check it periodically and do that. That clearly isn't the right way to do that, though. The right way to do that is have an interface either to a GPS receiver that gives you GPS time, or to have an interface to your station time. You know, as I understand it, most stations have an internal station time, and you have an interface to that. When do we plan to do that?
Well,
is that the question?
Why is it not included in everyone's system?
Why is it not included as a part of everyone's
system? Yeah, the question is, why isn't this not routinely included in every PSIP generator? And I guess my answer would be that it should be. And that, you know, we as one vendor are moving, I believe, to make it included, if not just automatically routinely, to make it an option which you can get at very reasonable cost.
Ray Smith, KCSM. I got two quick questions. I'll stand up, I guess, if I can. The first one is, how far in advance can you change the VCT tables, or do you have to plan? I mean, at some point you're going to have to change them at one time or another. How far in advance before you do the EITs?
Okay, let's see. As I understand it, the question is, at what point do you, you know, how far ahead can you change a VCT and somehow let the receiver know that this one doesn't count yet?
Right.
The VCT does have a provision for having two versions that are in the broadcast stream, one that's the current one and one that is the next one. There's actually a bit in the VCT, a flag, that says either this is the current one or this is the next one. However, there's no indication there that allows the receiver to automatically know when it's going to switch from the current one to the next one. What happens is eventually, you know, there comes a point at which the current one disappears and the bit in the other one switches to say it's now the current one. But there is no provision in the standard that lets you put the next VCT in the broadcast stream with some indication, you know, down to the microsecond as to when it becomes the current one.
And does the box actually know that has happened, or what do boxes typically do now?
Well, what would happen is that when the time comes that bit switches, that's a change in the version of the table, which would mean that the MGT would have a change in its version, and so the receiver would pick up that there's been a change in that PSIP table, and it would presumably respond very quickly to readjust to the new VCT and make whatever tuning changes are necessary, you know, whatever PID selection changes are necessary to go with the new configuration.
Okay, so a broadcaster would have to do that like a minimum 4 hours or some period in front of the typical 3 hour refresh of the EIT?
Yeah.
Sorry to go on that.
In practice, if you have a PSIP generator that's set up to do virtual channel table changes, you can typically program this into the PSIP generator as far in advance as you like, you know, weeks if necessary. And what it will do is simply automatically at the right times put in the new table. With our system, for example, I believe that we do not actually use the next table feature. We just always have a current table. But when the right time comes to change, we put in a new version of the current table. And that sort of data for what's going to happen well ahead of time is stored in the PSIP generator, not in the broadcast stream.
Okay, and then the last question, or the second question was on the second language and the display. Is that something that the broadcaster has to do, or is that taken care of software in the box?
That should be taken care of by the software in the box. That is, all the broadcaster has to do is, if the broadcaster wants to provide, say, in their EITs, titles in multiple languages, or in the ETTs, if they want to provide program descriptions in multiple languages, they can do that. And that data comes in with those languages tagged. That is, the receiver can tell what languages you have descriptions in and what languages you have titles in. And then, presumably, what the receiver manufacturer would do is allow the user to set up the receiver to say what languages they prefer, and then the receiver will automatically do the selection. Did that answer your question correctly?
Yes.
Yeah.
One more. Does Triventi or anyone that you know of make a PSIP stream analyzer so that once we have sent out our PSIP stream, we can be assured that it's really going out there and not getting somehow corrupted and or messed up by the cable company, say, for instance, et cetera, et cetera?
There are large numbers of PSIP analyzers on the market. We have one, and in fact, it's being demonstrated out in your lobby. But we're by far. In fact, there's also Sencor has the adherent analyzer, which they're also demonstrating out in your lobby. And I believe there must be four or five, six other companies that make ATSC digital bitstream analyzers, and the PSIP tables are one of the things that they virtually all analyze. So yes, it's quite possible to get an analyzer that will tell you all kinds of things about your. It won't necessarily tell you that the information in your PSIP tables are correct. You know, if somebody types it in wrong, it's going to be wrong. But they will ensure that the tables are there. The question is, can you have your analyzer kind of coupled with your PSIP generator? So it will check that what's actually coming out in the broadcast stream is the same thing that you thought you were putting in. And I don't know of any that have that set up, that kind of linkage now, but that certainly could be done. For example, if we thought there was a good market for it, we might well do it.
Are there any recommended buffer sizes for the EIT and such things? I was thinking of somebody who might be watching a football game on one of those other channels all afternoon, and they haven't been over to our channel to receive data, so they don't have a clue that's on. So is there a buffer? So if they watched this last night, they get EIT information?
Yeah, and this is something that's very much receiver dependent. There will be, I'm sure, some low-end receivers that don't do any buffering at all, and to all intents and purposes, they won't really have an on-screen electronic program guide. What they will still be able to do is every time you tune to that channel, they'll be able to tell you what's on that channel, because they can pick that immediately out of the broadcast stream. There will be other receivers that provide, a megabyte of memory or so, and they'll keep programming on all channels 2 weeks ahead of time. Every night when you turn the TV set off, they'll busily scan through all the channels and pick up the PSIP data from all the channels and cache it and continuously be able to give you a couple of weeks ahead of time. And it will be very much the CE manufacturers will do all the usual cost-benefit analysis to decide how much buffer they want to provide at what price point.
Is there any hopes of a standard to cable? So all this information will work in RSI stream? Because they're not going to broadcast our PSIs, our PSIPs.
I mean, you get into two issues there. One is you get into kind of a must-carry issue as to what are they required to do, and another one you get into is the kind of protocol standardization. The cable protocols are, they may not be exactly the same, but they're going to be close enough that receivers will be able to deal with both the cable protocols and the over-the-air protocols. There will also be translators that translate PSIP data from over-the-air protocols into a cable environment when they're being rebroadcast in cable. So as far as the technical possibility of having that data appear in the cable stream unchanged, that's certainly, we're moving toward that fairly rapidly, I think. As to the business considerations as to whether they're going to want to do that or all of that, I guess that's out of my department.
Okay, thank you very much.